It's Wednesday. That must mean it's Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We have Tim Hagel with us in our Iowa City studio this week, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
And I believe in our Des Moines studio, Rachel Caulfield. Are you there?
I certainly am.
Great. Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Drake University, also Associate Director of Drake's Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. I believe this is the first politics day where we are inside 100 days until the Iowa caucuses. Do you feel the increasing tension, Rachel?
I do. We're getting far more candidate attention, and I think more voters are paying attention.
Okay. We want to focus on that a little bit later in the program, as always. In this point in our four-year cycle, we want to pretty much every session we have here on Wednesday is devoted at least in some part to the presidential race. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about this budget deal that we've been seeing take shape over the last few days, seemingly appearing out of the mist, out of nowhere. Congressional leaders working late into the night last night to resolve last-minute issues with the bipartisan budget agreement reached between congressional leaders. This would be Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid. I don't know if I left anybody out there. But this paves the way for the House to vote as early as today. We are waiting to see if they will have a vote at this moment. Let's listen to John Boehner, outgoing Speaker of the House, set to retire from Congress on Friday. He used one of his final news conferences yesterday to make the announcement that a budget agreement has been reached by Congress.
This agreement will protect our economy and reduces the deficit. It secures more long-term entitlement reforms. It strengthens our national security and brings more certainty to next year's appropriations process. It protects more Americans from Obamacare and rejects all of the tax increases as proposed by the administration. Now, the agreement isn't perfect by any means, but the alternative was a clean debt ceiling increase without any additional support for our troops and without any entitlement reforms. So this is a good deal. Somebody got a bipartisan agreement in a town that isn't known for a lot of bipartisanship, you're going to see bricks flying from those that don't like the fact that there's a bipartisan agreement. But there is. It's a solid agreement, and I told my colleagues there isn't any reason why any member should vote against this.
But, of course, as John Boehner put it, there are bricks out flying. Tim Hagel, tell us what's going on here. How and why did this budget deal appear, and how did it get crafted so quickly by the leaders of both parties?
Well, the how part of it is part of the issue that some are going to have with it. And even Paul Ryan, the speaker in waiting, I suppose, has expressed some concerns about the process that members of the particularly Republican caucus weren't brought into it for discussions. It was something hammered out among the leadership, apparently. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's certainly something that, as they say, has irritated some members of the Republican caucus. They've also expressed some concerns about it basically undercutting the sequester, and as much as certainly Democrats have been unhappy with it because it hurt entitlements and domestic spending, Republicans were also concerned with it because it was also hurting defense spending. And so in some sense, this gets around that to a certain extent. But as at least the way Boehner characterized it is that there is some entitlement reform. It will help to continue to reduce the deficit. We'll see if that happens, but certainly there are going to be some Republican resistance to this.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, your view?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we see is we've made Congress more transparent. And this includes everything from having C-SPAN cameras in the chamber, which is a big one, to opening up a lot of committee hearings. Compromise has become harder and harder to reach. And so oftentimes these quote unquote backroom deals, these situations where you see genuine bipartisan compromise, that's something that we're not really accustomed to anymore. We're accustomed to seeing everything hammered out in public. But compromise is more possible in those backroom deals precisely because you know, when they have a camera pointed at them, members of Congress are more likely to take a hard line because they know that they have to go back to their voters. And there's a chance that somebody further to the left or further to the right will challenge them in a primary. And so when you go to the table and you say, OK, I'm willing to compromise on some of these core issues, that's not popular among a lot of voters. I think one of the key pieces to this is that John Boehner has, in some sense, a lot more freedom to negotiate than he has had in the past.
What do you make of the comment by Paul Ryan? Paul Ryan, we expect to be elected to Speaker of the House tomorrow. John Boehner retiring on Friday. He says, I think the process stinks, speaking of this so-called—
And John Boehner agreed with him.
this backroom deal. I guess Paul Ryan's probably glad there's no you-know-what in the barn, as far John Boehner put it. But is this, Tim Hagel, perhaps some kind of theater? We have the new House Speaker saying the process stinks, was not included in the process. It just raises question. Why wouldn't he be there? Is just for political cover's sake?
Well, maybe it's actually for political cover's sake that he's not there.
Exactly is what
yeah.
I meant.
Yeah, yeah, that basically if he's not part of it, then he can and actually there's some speculation as to whether he'll actually vote for it. I haven't seen any indication whether he'll vote for or against the deal. And to the extent that he has to deal with the Freedom Caucus, the more conservative part of the Republican members of Congress, that it may give him that ability to say, well, hey, I didn't vote in favor of this, so let's work on something better for next time. And, of course, Ryan's position is he wants to do this much more in advance, not to have the sort of brinksmanship that we've seen in the past where there's a threatening showdown and all of that. Now, I don't know how successful he'll be in that endeavor, but at least if he doesn't vote for the it's not termed this yet, but it may be considered the Boehner budget deal, that if he does vote for it, then all of a sudden it's already a one strike against him in the eyes of some, although for some they already have one or two strikes against Ryan right to start with.
In particular to Iowa, this budget deal in Congress has generated some frustration among senators from farm states, including Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, who says the proposal to cut $3 billion from crop insurance. The crop insurance program could lead to higher costs to taxpayers when disasters strike. Let's listen to Senator Grassley.
The public-private partnership keeps emergency disaster relief measures at the minimum and encourages individual risk management. The negotiators of this package could be putting the entire program at risk.
Grassley says there are areas other than crop insurance where cuts could be made, that farmers have shouldered their share of budget cuts already. So we're going to see resistance to this if it's called the Boehner budget, Rachel Caulfield. What's the path for it now, assuming today, tomorrow, perhaps it passes the House?
Well, perhaps it passes the House. You know, this is one of the reasons that budget deals are always difficult to negotiate is that any government spending has a group of people behind it that would like to see that government spending remain in place. So any sort of reforms to spending systems become very controversial. In this case, you have the blessings of the White House, and you know, I think it's fair to say you'll have a good number of Democrats sign on to this quote-unquote Boehner budget deal. And in that respect, you know, whether or not it's a done deal is kind of up in the air, but it certainly appears to have the necessary support at the outset to pass. And if it does, it's a huge gift to Paul Ryan. It means that essentially whether he votes for it or against it, and he has the freedom to vote against it if he needs to politically, but it gives him an opportunity to actually try to govern in the House aside from these looming fiscal crises and debt ceiling debates.
Mm-hmm. Do you see Paul Ryan's style of leadership as vastly different, Tim Hagel, than John Boehner? Do you see it setting up that way? Who knows what the reality will be? But given this sort of pregame show?
Well, yeah, certainly based on, as you say, the pregame show that, as we've already mentioned, that Ryan has indicated that he thinks that the process, the way it's been done most recently, is not good. has been problematic, and many people have been complained about Boehner's particular style. But on the other hand, maybe that's the style that you have to adopt to get things done. Now, of course, the immediate reaction to that is that, well, things haven't been getting done, and that's been part of the problem, and that's why you have this mini revolution on the part of the, as I say, the Freedom Caucus and the Republican of the Republicans in the House. And so maybe a different style will help to be more inclusive, bring them on board, even if they don't necessarily agree with everything that happens, if they're more part of the process. And that's often a way to try to work with dissenters in any body, is that as long as they're part of the process, they may feel less of a need to really resist to the utmost.
Yeah, and he's really, I mean, even in, you know, the method by which he has come to the speakership, to some extent, he's made clear he wants this to be a more inclusive body.
Rachel Caulfield is with us of Drake University. Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Day edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, where we like to survey the latest on the political landscape and get analysis of it from any number of analysts, political analysts we have across the state, Rachel and Tim Hagel. We're glad to have them with us this week to lend us their expertise. Let's flip the page, go to the 2016 race, as we mentioned, less than 100 days before the Iowa caucuses on, still slated for February 1st, right, Tim?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. We know in past history, we have to kind of check that every now and then, because there can be challenges to Iowa's first in the nation status, can't there?
There can.
So far, Iowa stands alone as the first to take on these candidates, if you want to put it that way. For more than 3 months, Donald Trump's rise in the polls has defied political gravity. And now polls in Iowa and nationally showing another one. Another outsider, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, topping Trump in the polls. I don't know, Rachel, do you have this, sort of those poll numbers ahead of you, or can you characterize them?
Well, so it looks like Ben Carson has pulled ahead of Donald Trump by about 4 points. This is the major national poll that people are citing. This is within the margin of error, so you don't want to make too much out of it. But statewide, this has been kind of an ongoing jockeying for position situation. And Ben Carson has, in Iowa polls, seemed to be the leader.
Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt, because we are seeing multiple polls statewide and nationwide, that there is something happening here, Tim.
Yeah.
Hagel, too?
Yeah, I would say so. Although whether it's happening nationally is hard to say, although I did see one article that was praising effectively Iowans because we're first, we're paying more attention early on, which is true. I mean, we're the ones that are sort of the focus right now, and along with New Hampshire, of course, and to a lesser extent, South Carolina and Nevada coming up. But we're seeing the trend started in Iowa, but the national poll that Trump or Carson may be 4 points ahead, but the margin of error was plus or minus 6 points.
That's
in
exactly
that poll,
right.
Which is just huge. So
huge.
We'll wait to see if the trend continues nationally.
Okay. Well, it has Donald Trump taking attention to it in front of a crowd of nearly 2,400 yesterday in Sioux City. Donald Trump repeatedly begged Iowa voters for their support.
I hate to say it, but the last long number of elections on the Republican circuit, the person that won Iowa did not get the nomination. Okay, I want to take away some of your mustard. Do you understand that? So could we do, and please do me a favor, let me win Iowa. And then I'm going to win. I'm telling you, we're going to win New Hampshire. And we're going to win South Carolina. A great poll just came out on North Carolina just a little while. A PPP poll. It was great. Some of you saw that. But great poll. But we're going to go on. We're going to win.
Okay, I thought he was ramping up to a Dean scream there for a moment. Trump also addressed recent polls showing Ben Carson as the leading GOP candidate in Iowa. He said that some of his advisors told him to spend less time here in Iowa, but that he will continue to campaign in the state.
When I heard the poll today, they said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to work harder in Iowa. I'm not leaving Iowa. I'm not leaving Iowa. Now, if I lose Iowa, I will never speak to you people again.
Donald Trump there. Always good for a soundbite.
he is always good for a soundbite. That's true.
What, Rachel, so acquaint us with the challenger here who maybe not overtaking Donald Trump on the GOP side. What does Carson have going for him that gets people standing in support of him?
Well, like Trump, he's an outsider. He's not somebody who spent his life in politics. And I think, you know, in some ways, the fact that these two candidates in particular seem to be leading the polls right now is really interesting because beyond being an outsider or both of them being outsiders, it's difficult to find much of anything that they have in common stylistically. They are very different kinds of candidates. Ben Carson is a very soft-spoken, intellectual, you know, former neurosurgeon. He's, you know, when you contrast him with Donald Trump's kind of bombastic style on the campaign trail, they're very, very different. And Ben Carson has gotten a lot of attention over the past few years from conservative voters, and he's kind of come up in esteem and recognition and awareness among that group of voters, that very staunch group of conservatives. Whether or not, you know, this is going to be a long-term lead for Ben Carson, it's hard to know. I think a lot of people are just getting to know him as a candidate.
Right. And I think his campaign admits that there's some policies to be fleshed out. And
absolutely.
Quite a number of inconsistencies being pointed out in the media. He has said, for instance, that he wants to loosen U.S. gun laws significantly. He has said it, but his campaign says he doesn't.
Yeah.
He says he wants to tax everyone at 10%. That's a system he said was drawn from the Bible. But Carson's campaign says could be 15% or something else. So I guess aides are saying, according to last reports, we'll come out with some detailed policies later in the month. Tim Hagel, the policies that Carson stands for, what are you seeing there?
Well, you know, the thing about Carson, and even as opposed to Trump, and aside from their different styles and so forth, as Rachel is pointing out, is that he hasn't been in the public eye, where even though Trump hasn't run for office before, he's been in the public eye. He understands the way the media works. He understands, to a certain extent, we may not think so, but he understands that, you know, things that he says that make quasi reaction, he has a way of dealing with that. Whereas Carson, this is all new to him, that maybe he's done some press conferences after successful operations of various things, separating the Siamese twins and so forth, but that's just not the same as being on the campaign trail. So he occasionally says things that maybe need clarification. Well, no surprise there. Most politicians, that's true, where they say something, whether it's in a debate or elsewhere, and they have to walk it back or clarify it or whatever it happens to be. That maybe is happening a little bit more to Carson, although that was a little bit more early on that was happening, but it's still occurring. And so there's a learning process there, and he admits that. But at a certain point, people are going to want him to be a little more on point and be sure of what he's saying because, of course, as president, you don't want a lot of that to be happening.
Interesting. Yes,
yeah,
Rachel, go ahead.
You know, taking the lead spot is it's a hard place to be because all of a sudden all the questions and all the, you know, critiques are directed toward you. So I think tonight's debate is going to be interesting for Carson.
We want to talk about that in a few minutes. I want to mention this undecided GOP poll. It's interesting also. We want to talk about the Democrats here because it's quite different here. A new CBS New York Times poll released yesterday finding that the vast majority of Republicans have not made up their minds on a primary candidate. It's 70% of respondents said that it's still too early to say for sure that their selection is the person they will ultimately back. So we want to reach out to you, our listeners, this hour. Have you decided on a candidate? GOP caucus participants specifically, are you still undecided about who you will support, or are you staying with Trump if that's who you supported before? Have you switched over to Ben Carson, perhaps Marco Rubio, perhaps Jeb Bush? Well, you're not alone in your undecided capacity there, mindset. Share your thoughts with us and tell us why. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or share your views on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk a little bit about the debate. We'll go to break in just a moment and continue our discussion. Tonight's GOP debate in Boulder, Colorado brings the 10 remaining Republican contenders together. It's always a crucial moment, but this is a crucial moment for many of them. Two outsiders, Ben Carson and Donald Trump, dominating so far this crowded field of GOP establishment. These are well-known senators and governors. What will you be watching for in particular in this debate, Tim Hagel?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what, if any, reaction Donald Trump has to Carson's rise in the polls. Again, nationally, if you look at especially the average, Trump is still ahead and apparently will get the prime spot. But because Carson seems to be gaining and Trump's maybe talked about a little bit on the campaign trail, as the cuts that we've heard indicated, whether he go after Carson in some particular way or like he has suggested in the past. You also see that Rubio is on the rise. Will more attention be directed to him? Will he see this as his moment to really try to stand out? And then, of course, you still have the candidates that are even some of the ones on the main stage, but particularly the ones that are in the early debate, that some are suggesting that maybe this is their last hurrah. They need to really make their mark now or never. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, because some of them are running such low-level campaigns that they can probably hang on for a bit longer, although the question is why in the case of some. But they do need to have this opportunity, especially in the early debate where there are only four people, that they have perhaps more of an opportunity to try to make their mark, although probably a lower viewership.
What or who will you be watching in particular, Rachel?
Well, I think it'll be particularly interesting to see if Trump pivots to take on Ben Carson the way he's taken on Jeb Bush, and see if, you know, is he still going to use Jeb Bush as his primary target, or is he going to redirect to Ben Carson? If he redirects to Ben Carson, that could be good for Jeb Bush, although his campaign is clearly in a time period when they have to kind of reposition and figure out a strategy forward. I think it's also going to be interesting to see Carly Fiorina's response to her very dramatic decline in the polls, which seems to be kind of unexplained.
Yeah, what happened there? Did she? What happened there? She was shot up after that last debate, really a recognized star of that last debate, putting Donald Trump in his place. Many saw that. What happened, do you think?
It's kind of a fascinating thing. I don't know exactly what has happened, but it'll be interesting to see if she tries to reassert herself to get another bounce. She's gotten a bounce out of both previous debates.
Mm-hmm. Carly Fiorina. Tim Hagel, before we go, just a few seconds, thoughts on her?
Some have suggested that she really didn't capitalize on her moment, that she sort of disappeared and wasn't doing enough events. The other thing maybe is that you get attention for one thing and you need to be able to expand on that, and perhaps she wasn't able to.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. And in the second half hour, I want to pick over the 2016 race, as we've started to do here. We want to learn from you, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent, what about your personal experience draws you to a particular candidate? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Why are you drawn to your candidate? I'll just put it that way. 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, picking apart the latest on the political landscape on the eve, it is the day of the third Republican debate to be held tonight in Boulder, Colorado. We want to talk about that, as well as also on the Democratic side, what's been happening there. We want to hear from you. Tell us about your personal experience, and what about your personal experience draws you to a particular candidate in the race? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, and polls showing that Ben Carson rising in the polls. Donald Trump has been the leader in all of the polls for over 3 months. Ben Carson now challenging that front-runner status. Ben Carson's campaign appears to be capitalizing on the notion that he's a political outsider, highlighting that fact in a new television ad. It's a 30-second spot airing in South Carolina featuring Carson standing next to an empty cardboard box that says Washington Political Class on one side and a sketch of the Capitol on the other.
I'm Ben Carson, and I'm running for president. The political class and their pundit buddies say impossible. He's too outside the box. Well, they do know impossible. Impossible to balance the budget, impossible to get border security, impossible to put aside partisanship. I'm Ben Carson. I'm running for president, and I'm very much outside the box. There must be a good idea in there somewhere. I'm Ben Carson, and I approve this message.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, asking about the particular candidates you support or have questions about. Bob in Des Moines, you have a question about Ben Carson.
Yes, thank you. One quick comment, and then I've got a question. I'll just hang up and listen to your comments. I'm registered a Democrat, but I generally consider myself independent. But I'm leaning Democrat this year only because it scares me how so many of the more extreme Republicans, they focus so much on their religion and creationism that they want to deprive our kids of learning science, even though there's so much proof otherwise. And I have heard that Ben Carson does not believe in evolution. Now, is that true? And if that is true, how do we know that he won't try to impose his religious beliefs on our kids and deprive them of that science education?
Okay. Bob and DeMore. Yep. Mm-hmm. As you said, you take your answer off the air. Thank you very much. Great question. Bob, actually, we had that a little bit before the break, did some research here. In a speech delivered in 2012, Ben Carson said he believes that the theory Charles Darwin came up with, in his words, was something that was encouraged by the adversary, a reference to Satan, and that the Big Bang theory was part of the fairy tales pushed by highfalutin scientists as a story of creation. So I guess Rachel, Tim, I don't know what you know here, but sure, it looks like we can classify Ben Carson as a creationist.
We can answer that question. Ben Carson's been really interesting, particularly on the issue of religion on the campaign trail. He speaks about his religion in very broad tones and makes very specific appeals on a few issues. I think one of the things that will come out of his time now as a front runner will be increased attention to how religion has shaped his views. He's a Seventh-day Adventist. And, you know, he speaks about kind of finding religion when he was a young child. He doesn't talk a lot about how it informs his beliefs today, except that it does.
Mm-hmm. What about Bob's in Des Moines' concern about this being sort of the guiding force if Ben Carson would be in the White House, Tim Hagel?
Well, certainly you can have some concerns along those lines. And he was asking the question, I think, well, regardless of the president's beliefs, we still, of course, have various limitations. And one of the things I do is teach a variety of Establishment Clause cases to my undergraduate constitutional law class. And we just covered that topic recently. And so there's a limit to what a president can do along those lines. But the interesting part of this that he ended the question with, the caller ended the question with, was the idea is, well, maybe a president can emphasize science education or de-emphasize the funding and things of that nature. But there are limits to that, too, as to how much can occur. And I think you get a lot of pushback if somehow you're trying to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to decrease science funding in this area or something along those lines. So I don't think that in terms of what's going on in the schools would change a whole lot. But what president can do, of course, having the bully pulpit, is to emphasize one thing or another and to bring that out in various ways. And that's certainly something that those of us here in Iowa or elsewhere that are looking at can take into consideration as we're deciding who to support.
Mm-hmm. In tonight's debate, let's talk about some of the other candidates there. Jeb Bush, the one-time GOP frontrunner, we've been hearing in the last few days, slashing campaign staff and costs, enlisting the two presidents he has in his family to reassure some worried donors about his White House hopes. His campaign says tonight's debate is the starting point for a sharper, more nimble, aggressive candidate. What will it take, Rachel, for Jeb Bush to stage a comeback, you think?
Well, campaigns have a quality of evolution. I mean, if you look back 4 years, you know, Mitt Romney was kind of on the ropes. Nobody quite knew if he could pull it out because polls were showing, particularly in Iowa, that Newt Gingrich was leading, or then Herman Cain was leading. I think the key right now is to remain consistent, he's got a great group of strategists behind him. In Iowa, he's got a large staff. Sometimes that can be a real strength, but sometimes, and particularly in a year when voters appear to be looking at the anti-establishment candidates as a very attractive choice, Jeb Bush wants to paint himself as not part of the establishment, and that's hard for him to do.
Mm-hmm. Coming from a political dynasty, yes. It is.
And,
yes.
And maybe sitting down with your brother and your father is not the best way to signal to those same conservative voters that you're in it and that you should be a candidate that they take seriously.
Tim Hagel, react to this quote taken from the Washington Post today. Unlike in the previous two debates, Bush comes into tonight's showdown wounded as a candidate following his decision to make a significant salary cutbacks and spending reductions in the face of weaker than expected fundraising numbers over the past 3 months. In short, the vultures are circling. Do you agree with that in the Washington Post?
Not entirely. Certainly that if you're having problems in a campaign, you do need to make adjustments. And this is something that happens on a fairly regular basis from one campaign or another. I think what happened to John McCain, where he basically stopped his campaign for a while because of funding and other issues and yet ended up being the nominee. So it's not the death knell, so to speak, of the campaign. But certainly the dynamics of this particular cycle for the GOP are just so strange. And maybe you thought that Jeb Bush was going to be and was the front runner and was going to be the ultimate nominee, still could be. And as Rachel was saying, that Romney was leading the polls and fell back. And one of the things that we're certainly aware of here in Iowa is that these people pop up and pop down for different reasons. We aren't seeing the same reasons this time as we saw 4 years ago on the GOP side. But it does mean that you do have to reevaluate your campaign and maybe come in with a different strategy if you hope to ultimately be successful. And the thing about Bush is that he has the resources to last perhaps longer than some others. We've seen Perry and Walker, of course, already drop out, and they were thought, at least Walker was thought to be highly regarded here in Iowa. So we kind of have to wait and see if they're willing to stick it out.
Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. We'd like to have you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to the phones. Jeff is in Des Moines. Thank you for waiting, Jeff. What are you seeing? What are you sensing? What are you feeling?
Well, I see this as a whole media frenzy fantasy.
Which part of it?
The entire year before it actually happens aspect of it.
Well, we are less than 100 days from the Iowa caucuses, and they do, by all accounts, determine quite a bit, right?
Well, supposedly, but this
okay.
is like crazy. I am a registered Republican and haven't voted in Iowa for a long time, except for some local stuff, but I'm sorry I'm registered because I still get the Republican media and the Republican little booklets and mail and fundraising.
Jeff, do you have a question for us?
Well, I see Bernie Sanders as reasonable, but it is radical to expect that we can completely have a revolution. But that's what we need, is a revolution of everything. It's been tainted since the First World War.
Okay.
We're slaves to, the election is just a way of appeasing everyone, thinking that we're doing the right thing, the conscientious people doing the right thing. We used to want to become or belong to a party, but, it's like kind of a country club. You wouldn't want a country club that had you as a member. So,
Groucho Marx's line.
Jeff, thanks for your view from Des Moines. Since you mentioned Bernie Sanders there, let's pick up, as we're getting late in the hour, let's pick up with the Democratic side. Wow, a new poll out here. I could barely believe the number here. Maybe it doesn't reflect too much, but with Vice President Joe Biden officially out of the running and the Benghazi testimony behind her, Hillary Clinton in the a poll surging to a 41-point lead here in Iowa, according to the results of yesterday's Monmouth University poll, survey of likely Democratic caucus goers. Clinton with 65% support, Bernie Sanders 24% third place, Martin O'Malley 5%, and interesting here. Rachel, do you think, have you seen other polls? Is this an outlier? Do we need to wait for others to come in to confirm this or not?
Well, this is interesting. I think a number of pollsters who are finding similar results are kind of holding off on their release of their results because they're, it seems too outrageous. they want to check, check on everything, dot their I's and cross their T's kind of thing. But yeah, other polls are showing a similar surge for Hillary Clinton. And this was Hillary Clinton's week. This was a good week for Hillary Clinton.
We didn't know it was that good, though.
With Biden dropping out of the race, the Benghazi hearing, and then for Iowa voters, I think the JJ dinner and the Katy Perry rally, it was a good week for Hillary Clinton.
Right. Let's listen to a little bit from the JJ dinner, the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. Bernie Sanders used his speech at that annual dinner to highlight the differences between him and Hillary Clinton. Without mentioning her by name, Sanders fired off a series of criticisms while listing off his unwavering opinions toward the Keystone XL pipeline, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, the Iraq War, the Defense of Marriage Act. He also talked about how far his campaign has come.
6 months ago, when I began my campaign for President of the United States of America, and when we announced that we were going to take on the political and economic establishment of this country, very few people knew who I was. That's the fact. I may have a big ego, but that's the fact. We were at about 3% in the polls. We had no money. We had no political organization. Well, in the last 6 months, things have changed.
Bernie Sanders this past weekend in Des Moines at the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. For her part, the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, focused at that dinner heavily on the widening gap between the upper and middle class. And while Sanders focused on the differences between himself and Clinton, Clinton did not, interestingly, return fire. Instead, launched criticism at the Republican Party.
They're pushing the same failed policies that crashed our economy before. You know what they are: cutting taxes on the super wealthy, letting big corporations write their own rules, busting unions, ignoring the middle class. We've heard all this before, and we know what it does. And of course, none of them is serious about climate change. I love it when they're asked about it. You know what their answer is: I'm not a scientist. Well, why don't they start listening to those who are scientists and understanding what we're up against around the world?
Hillary Clinton rallying her troops on Saturday in Des Moines at the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. And let's get back to the phones before our hour comes to a close. It's zipped by so quickly. Mary on our line, where are you calling from, Mary?
I am calling from rural Ollie, Iowa, down in the southeastern part of the state. Sigourney is our county seat in Keokuk County.
Wonderful. What's on your mind?
Well, I am a regular attendee of our annual Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner, and that is the big event for the Iowa Democratic Party every year. And in the presidential year, it's always wonderful. It's always exciting. And I was I loved the introduction of Bernie Sanders into the process. And I've loved his comments, but I was highly disappointed the night of the Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner. After he spoke, he and his whole delegation walked out of the dinner. And that's extremely rude. He never mentions the fact that he's running on the Democratic ticket. He never acknowledges the fact that he is now a Democrat, and he wasn't before, and I understand that. I love his message, but I think that he is not a true Democrat. And I like his chutzpah, but he's not viable. And that's my opinion. Thank
okay,
you very much.
Mary, thank you for giving us your opinion. 1-866-780-9100. Patrick on our Facebook page says, with two people dropping out of the Democratic primary, will Lawrence Lessig get more attention or even get a chance to participate in the debates. I'd like to at least hear his concerns mentioned in public debates, writes Patrick on our Facebook page. There's a name people are like you say, well, who is this? Right, Tim?
Yeah, no, it's even in the Democrats poll, because it has a much smaller number of candidates that, they had all five in the first debate. But I kept saying, well, look, if Chafee in particular and O'Malley and Webb, if they're polling below 1%, why are they even there, even in the first debate? But you've got to fill out the field. Now, of course, it's going to be down to three. But the fact that it's down to three doesn't mean that Lessing is going to get that opportunity unless he starts showing up in the polls. And it's a hard thing to do if you don't have some sort of national reputation to start with.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, David Yepsen, I've had him on this program many times. He wrote about Iowa politics for the Des Moines Register for many decades, I think over 30 years. He said of this recent Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner, the event felt like Democrats have concluded the race is over. Rachel, do you agree with that?
Well, I actually don't. I think among Bernie Sanders supporters, they certainly wouldn't concede that point for a minute. There was a huge rally. They marched across the bridge to the dinner itself. They were very active and involved. I think, like the caller earlier, Jeff, there's a group of people who are thoroughly unhappy with establishment politics on either side of the aisle. And Bernie Sanders is tapping into some of that. And it's not exclusively Democrats, which is a difficult thing for his campaign. But it's also, he's not identified himself or labeled himself as a Democrat. But certainly, he has some people on the right who are interested in his anti-establishment message. And in that way, I think he's kind of the anti-politician mm-hmm. of this campaign. And then you have people on the far left who are interested in his campaign. As the party is as a whole, I think it benefits from healthy competition.
Okay, let's go to Julia. She will have to be our last call, calling from Union County, Iowa. Julia, you are a supporter of a candidate who's not been mentioned this hour, I don't believe.
That's right. Why not?
Sure. Who are you? Who are you supporting?
he's electable.
You're talking about Martin O'Malley.
Yes, he's electable. He's a rising star. He doesn't have Hillary's baggage. He doesn't have Bernie's far left. Both of which, those two candidates, turn off a lot of people. And I think he's a rising star, and that's who we're supporting. And he might not get on the ticket, the top billing on the ticket this time around, but he might get a vice presidential bid. And I think that's what Barack Obama's a rising star. Martin O'Malley's a little bit rough around the edges, and he's not as slick as a speaker. I'll say it. He's not as slick. He doesn't deliver those hot sound bites, but he's genuine. I love what he's done as mayor and as governor, and I was impressed with what he had to say about climate change and his plans for energy efficiency, and so there.
Okay. Julia, thank you. From Union County, you're our last caller on this Politics Day edition of River to River. So Martin O'Malley, Rachel Caulfield, still in the game, still has a chance, or is he, as many analysts say, running for vice president?
It's hard to say. It's been an uphill battle for Martin O'Malley from the beginning. His poll numbers have increased. I've said on this program before, I think one of the interesting things about Martin O'Malley is Bernie Sanders probably has a ceiling. His poll numbers haven't increased significantly. Hillary Clinton probably has a ceiling. And I think there's room for growth for Martin O'Malley. Does it take him to the nomination? That's a much harder road for him.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, back to Marco Rubio. You mentioned him earlier in the program. Is Marco Rubio the GOP establishment's new favorite? We have just a few seconds left.
I don't know about the new favorite. He's certainly somebody that people are looking at right now. And as we've seen before, that the focus sorts of goes from one candidate to another. And this is Rubio's time, and he needs to make the most of it.
Okay. Well, many of us will be watching tonight. I know you right. will be, Tim, and you also will be, Rachel Caulfield.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Drake University, also Associate Director at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. I'll be in Des Moines tonight at a public event I wanted to remind you about, a civil dialogue with two prominent Iowans representing opposing viewpoints on the political spectrum at the Des Moines Social Club. I'll be talking with Iowa Executive Director Donna Redwing and Bob Vanderplatz, President and CEO of the conservative Christian organization, The Family Leader. You can attend that. I believe it starts at 5:30 this evening. I'll be there. And I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of River to River. Produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Also help from John Pemble in Des Moines. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.